for hosting, and we're off to a great start. Wonderful meal, and we appreciate it very much. This is Brady's former stomping grounds, so he's somewhat nervous that when we tour the campus, there's going to be some vestiges of his legacy here. So I just want you all to be aware of that, and it's out there, I'm sure. We'd like to welcome Representative Mouche to this meeting today, representative from this area, and you're welcome to join us at the table if you want, but welcome to the meeting. So the next meeting will be in August. We do not have a date set. It will have a goal of trying to complete all of our assignments. It will be at we'll be using the new med school as the meeting place, so we will get that date to you as soon as we're able to coordinate things with the incoming administration and get their schedules right. On your agenda for today, if you look at the 215 item, it makes sense to move that to till tomorrow morning when we have a facility discussion going on, so that fits in line more with that. So we'll just move that until tomorrow morning. Okay, we'll go right into the agenda then with the presentation by Representative of the North Dakota University System regarding the higher ed funding formula, Tammy Dolan. I always forget that. Thank you. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved.
Morning, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Tammy Dolan with the University System Office, and I will be presenting the first two items on your agenda today. And then after I'm done, Lisa Feldner will be coming up to talk about the administrative cost portion. So the first thing that you've asked for today is to talk about the higher education funding formula. What I'll be talking about today, I'll walk through the per credit hour report for you so you know what the changes have been in credit hour production. And then we'll talk a little bit about the costs and how we will implement the 90% or the 90% budgets that the governor asked for. So we'll go through all of those items for you today and talk a little bit about salary adjustments and other inflationary components as you've requested, and then talk about the changes that we would ask for the formula this time around. So the first slide I have up, and do you all have a copy of the handout with you? So this would be on slide 3. Tried to make the numbers a little bit bigger this time, but there's still a lot of them, so this slide might be hard to read. What you're looking at here is the completed credit hour report for the 2013-15 biennium. So that's for all credits successfully completed by students at each institution during the 2013 period ending June 30th, 2015, or ending with that academic year. This will be the basis going forward. According to the statutory formula, this will be the basis for the ongoing formula payments for the institutions for the 17-19 biennium. If you look, the first column shows you the 2011-13 adjusted student credit hours, that were about 7.3 million total credit hours for all institutions. That is, those credits were the basis for the current biennium's funding model. Now, based on the second column shows you the student credit hours for the 13-15 biennium. This is the initial input, the actual credits that were completed of 2.1 million. After applying the instructional program factor, that looks at the level of course, the type of course taken, and the level of course taken. Applying that weighting factor increases the model to 7 million credits. Then there's a credit completion factor applied, which is based on the number of credits in the 2013-15 column, and that's all statutory. So those rates are applied based on the columns in the 2013 column, and you'll see that they vary by institution because each institution's credits vary. As they get smaller, as less credits are produced, the weighting factor increases. And then once you hit a threshold at a certain high volume that only UND and NDSU it applies to, you don't receive any weighting for your credits over and above the formula. The changes between 2011 and 13, some of the credit completion factors did adjust. Lake Regions went from 1.4 to about 1.5. Williston's went down because their credit production increased from, it was 1.8, their new factor is 1.7. And Dickinson State's went up because their credit production decreased. It was 1.2 and it's now 1.4. The other credit completion factors all stayed the same. The next factor is...
Representative Beadle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Tammy, just a quick question for clarification. You mentioned on the credit completion factor that only UND and NDSU reach the volume level to be the 1.0.
Right.
I notice up there NDSCS is also listed at 1.0. Is that a typo or is that a weighted based off of the institutional size factor?
No, thank you very much. That is a very good point. NDSCS is at a credit completion factor of 1 because they're the only institution that qualifies for the institutional size factor. That was a change instituted by the last Legislative Assembly, so you can only qualify for one or the other. So thank you for pointing that out. I forgot to mention it.
Representative Martinson.
Tammy, would you remind me why the completion factor goes up when your credits actually go down?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Representative Martinson, yes, I will. The credit completion factor is similar to the small school size factor that's in the K-12 funding model. So as you reach a certain level of credit production, there's an economies of scale factor where certain costs stabilize. As you get smaller, you still have a lot of those fixed costs. So even as credit production decreases, you still have that same level of cost. So this is a factor to kind of balance that out and provide for more of those fixed costs in the formula that affect smaller schools more heavily than some of the larger schools.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, so Tammy, at what point Do you lose students and you actually get less money rather than lose students and factors increase so you maintain your status quo? Doesn't that kind of defeat the purpose of a formula?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there. What I will show you on the next slide is that there are institutions that are losing money because of their credit production decreases. So if I could wait to explain that till the next slide, I'll show you how it works out dollar-wise based on these credit levels, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chairman. So then when you apply the institutional size factor, as I mentioned, Wahpeton is the only school that qualifies for that. That's because their actual square footage of their campus is so much larger than the others in comparison to their credit production that they qualify for that. If any of the other institutions, either square footage would increase dramatically or credit production would decrease dramatically, they may qualify. But right now, NDSCS is the only one that qualifies for that. So in the end, as you look at the credit production, in summary, the 2013-15 adjusted student credit hours after application of all the factors, weighting factors, they have increased from 7.3 million in the first, that's in the first column, to about 7.5 million, an increase of about 200,000 for 2013-15. So the next step in the model then is to take those credits and apply it to a rate that's established in statute. And if you look in the middle of the chart on page 4, you will see those statutory rates. A couple of things to point out about that. Last session, the legislature equalized the rates within the different tiers. So the two-year institutions, all of them, receive $114.88 per credit hour. The four-year regional institutions receive $107.33 per credit hour, and the research institutions receive 72.63. So by taking the credits that I just described in the first page and applying those rates, the third to last column shows you what the formula would have generated for a base budget for the institutions just simply based on credit production. That doesn't take into account any other inflationary factors at all. It's just the credit production and the statutory rates.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Delmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the med school included in with UND on these?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Delmore, it is. And then the funding is split between the two institutions after the formula is
okay, but right
calculated.
Now the med school is in with UND.
Yes, yes. So before looking at the 10% reduction that the governor's asked for, that third to last column shows you that the formula would generate $627.6 million for all of the institutions, an increase of about $13.2 million. A couple of things that I want to point out about that is it does vary by institution. So you'll see, for example, BSC, based on their production alone, their budget would have increased by $1.2 million because their credits are going up. If you follow down to the State School of Science, their credit production actually went down. And so they would receive a base decrease of funding of $1.4 million. Dickinson is another institution that would receive a decrease of 16%, which is $4.2 million. That, if you'll recall in the formula, there is a section in the code that has a hold harmless, the minimum amount payable, it's not hold harmless, a minimum amount payable that would limit any institution's reduction in budget based on credit production to only 4% per biennium or per year. And so the problem with that clause is there's a sunset on that clause this time, and that is supposed to expire June 30th, 2017. So the number showing for Dickinson, the $4.2 million, is what their base budget would have decreased if that minimum amount payable provision is not continued forward or not approved. If that were in place, the most their budget would decrease would be $1 million. And the reason that was instituted at the beginning when the statute was developed was when, again, it relates to some of those fixed costs that exist. You can't just stop some of those operations immediately because credit production went down. So this builds in a bit of a lag time for the institution to react to the lower funding level and make the appropriate changes to what their new normal would be once funding levels out. So again, in summary, the formula before the 10% reduction would have increased funding by about 13.2 million or 2.1%. And in a sense, one of the bullet points you've asked us to talk about is the cost to continue for the institutions. This, in my mind, really is the cost to continue for the institutions because it's a statutory formula. The law would say that this is the amount of funding that it would generate. So this would be part of their base. Now,
Senator Holmberg.
Tammy, could you repeat that? Because, as you know, in the past there has been this wall of misunderstanding between many in the legislature and the board office regarding the use of that term cost to continue. Could you repeat that again, please?
Actually, dislike the term cost to continue very much, but that's what it said on the agenda, so that's what I called it. This is the statutorily derived cost to continue of the formula. What this is only on credit production. It doesn't include any of the other things we've talked about over the years for cost to continue, as like second year salary increases or operating inflation, any of those. But this is just the statutorily derived costs of the formula.
So, Tammy, what you're saying is the traditional cost to continue no longer exists.
The formula, Mr. Chairman, does not address those costs.
Yep.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Now, the next page, page 5, is the same numbers for original base budget and credit adjusted credits. But to institute the governor's 10% reduction for base budget purposes, we've been working with OMB, and we believe we're all in agreement that this would be probably the most effective way of implementing that 10% reduction. So what we would do would be reduce that statutory rate by 10% across the board in all the tiers. So this would allow the equalization within tiers that the legislature achieved last biennium. It would allow that to stay in place, so the rates would be equal for all of the institutions. So in this model, we reduced those rates by 10%, applied it to the same credit production, and came up with a 90% base budget of $564.9 million. And that would be a $49 million decrease from the prior biennium. And you'll notice that each institution, it varies there. And if you look at the bottom, it doesn't come down to a 10% reduction. And that's because the new credit production that we talked about for 2013-15 is already assumed within this model. So this would be a complete picture of the funding, new base funding going forward, and this will be what we would be building our 90% base budget off of going forward.
Representative Martinson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Tammy, you said that, you know, the term that we've used for years, of course, was the cost to continue. Mm-hmm. So, and you say that this doesn't have, at least not that term that we normally mm-hmm. would use. So Does this budget exclude, like, we didn't have health care at one time, we didn't have salary increases at one time. Mm-hmm. Is this the absolute total amount that higher ed, if it goes through with the 10% reduction, mm-hmm. would request and nothing more?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is the 90% level for the funding formula that the office will be, that the system will be requesting. You're right, and that it doesn't include any salary increases for 2017-18. It doesn't include any health insurance cost increases. None of those are built into there. We're taking, as we did in the prior biennium, we didn't include those in our base request. Rather, we are expecting to be, that in the governor's budget, if, as he does with all state agencies, none of the state agencies ask for salary increases for 2017-19 or health insurance increases. Those are added by the governor. So if that happens, if those are added into his budget, that would be an addition onto this. But we're not expecting to ask for any additional funding for the formula other than what's here, with one exception. The one exception is we will be asking to reinstate that hold harmless clause or the minimum amount payable. So if you look at the Dickinson State line here, they, under the new model, they would show a decrease initially of 24.5%. We will be asking for the difference to about $3 million or so to bring them back up to that 90. It would minimize their reduction to only 14%, so it would be like a 10% base budget drop, and then a 4%, so they're only being affected by 96% of that cut. So that's the only additional money that we would ask for.
Representative Martinson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if we would do the whole harmless, doesn't that defeat the purpose of a formula? It's really not a formula if you say, well, oh, you're going to get a little less than we want you to have, so we're going to...
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Martinson, it still is, to me, it's still a formula. This gives the institutions that are decreasing in enrollment and funding time to react to those lower funding level so that they can make adjustments and adjust programs or staffing or whatever that is that they need to do. And those costs can't be realized right away, so they need time to adjust to that. And so I don't think it defeats the purpose of the formula, and I think it helps those institutions be able to react and adjust their spending accordingly.
Representative Martinson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, so Tammy, when we did this, we knew that Dickinson was going to have problems. Mm-hmm. They knew they were going to have problems. So at what point do we say, well, you've had enough time to solve those problems? And are you going to be able to tell us next session what Dickinson has done to alleviate some of those problems?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we would be able to tell you that the one of the beauties of the formula is Dickinson has been aware that they're going to have a lower level of funding since 2015, around June 30th, 2015. So they have been making adjustments already to deal with that and probably holding positions open, looking at other types of costs, reevaluating their whole operation in order to adapt to that. So they are already making adjustments, and we can certainly, there's people from Dickinson here that could give you some of the more details on that. I think I forgot the last part of your question. Will there come a time? Now I got it. At some point, yes. I mean, eventually, this would level out, and they would no longer, their funding would no longer be decreasing, and they'd be at that lowest level. And with any luck, we hope they're there already. By next biennium, they'll be on the upswing again.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I would just add that it was well before 2015 that they knew they would have financial difficulties.
That was just this, the funding I'm talking about here, the decreased funding here. They have known that, and they made the same kind of adjustments the prior biennium as well.
But they knew that, Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. before 2015.
Sure.
Senator Flagel.
Your Chairman and Tammy, the formula took place in 2013, and there was a 4% minimum maximum drop. So was Dickinson at 4% plus 4% plus 4%? How many am I at? Am I at 4? 4 plus 4 plus 4
Three.
Plus 4. And then, according to the formula, a potential another 24%.
Yes, they have.
So in essence, a 40% pending reduction.
Depends on how many 4% there were, but yes.
There was four of them, correct?
They've had reduction, well, it's 13, 15, and then three, I think.
4% per year?
It's 4% per biennium is how it's been implemented.
Okay.
So, yeah, not 4% per year, 4% per biennium, because we only look at this every 2 years when the legislature's in town. So, yes, they have had, each time, they've had that 4% reduction, and now this time they would have the 4% and then plus the 10% from the governor's budget. Mr. Chairman, that really concluded the discussion about the formula that I had intended to have. I think we've, unless you have more questions on the details, the last bullet that you asked about was if there's any suggestions for changes to the formula. And as I mentioned, the only change I would ask would be the reinstatement of the minimum amount payable statute permanently. So that it's there for all the institutions as time goes on, if they also are experiencing reductions. And outside of that, really, last session there were a lot of tweaks, which I think made the formula stronger and better. I would ask that there weren't any changes to the formula, if at all possible, so that we can let it work for a couple of bienniums. We'd like to see it stay in place so we have this stability and we can see how it actually works. And then if we need to, at that point, tweak it. But other than the minimum amount payable, I would ask for no changes to the formula.
Representative Delmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tammy, without any tweaking or anything of this, how are the university systems singly going to handle increase? We know there'll be increase in health care. Pay raises, et cetera, is there another place where that will be available to them? Or is it strictly with the formula and they just have to decide what they're going to cut in order to be able to make payroll for their employees?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Delmore, and members of the committee, unless the funding is added by the governor and the governor's budget and then approved by the Legislative Assembly for any salary increases or health insurance costs that are going up, the institutions would have to find that money from within this existing amount, similar to other state agencies, and determine how they can do that and what cuts they would need to make to fund those types of increases.
Representative Martinson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just my opinion and a comment, but I think that that's a fairly significant ask that you want to have a minimum, and I think that might be difficult.
The 4%.
Yeah, that's not really a question, just a comment that I think to keep that in is going to be difficult. Thank you. Maybe there's some other opinions in the committee, but
Tammy, I have a question, or maybe it's just a statement, and you can confirm if it's correct, and that is that with the first two iterations of the formula, we were in a different economic time frame, and there was the term the Bakken premium was used, and that meant a one-time bump to Williston and to Dickinson, and neither of those are in this now. And so what we're hearing from you is this is the base, and they recognize that those were one time, and they're not here.
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. Those are not built into this amount at all. Those were one-time adjustments made by the Legislative Assembly, and they're not built into the base.
Further questions on this particular area? I want to thank you for the early work on this, and it reiterate what you said, something about having a model in place. It's been overhauled or modified a little bit, but there is something to be said for a predictability in terms of some base expectations and the fact that the institutions have had an opportunity to at least be aware of what their number was going to be, their credit, adjusted credits were going to be, is somewhat helpful from the standpoint of planning. So, but thank you for the early work on this.
Did you want me to just move into the next agenda item?
That would be good. Yep, thank you.
Okay, the next agenda item is a report on the budget reductions that were made by the institutions as a result of the allotment process. And that's probably the first thing I'd like to point out, as it is a process. We did have, I'll go through the guidelines and some of the adjustments that were made, but it is a process. The institutions did put a plan in place. It's a living and breathing plan, so it'll continue to evolve as time goes on. But they all have reacted and made the necessary adjustments to their expenses to meet the required allotment. This first slide is just some totals, so you can see by institution how the reductions were actually taken. For all of the institutions, including the School of Medicine, total reduction in their appropriation was almost $30 million. Each institution had a little bit different approach to that. As far as for the appropriation lines that you see in the appropriation bills, these are the adjustments that were made to those lines. So of the $30 million, almost $27 million was adjusted out of the operations line, and about $3 million was taken from your capital assets line. So operations is everything from salaries and wages to utilities, all those operating costs. And the capital assets would be things like capital projects or other repairs done around the campus. So what was the process that we followed when the allotment was became a reality? The system office and the campuses, we worked together to develop a series of guidelines that we first issued in January, towards the end of January, and then those were revised just slightly after the actual allotment was announced. I won't read all these but the guidelines did include a multitude of ways to reduce costs on both an ongoing and a one-time basis. It allowed for short-term reactions, more of those one-time adjustments, and then long-term costs like reducing salary costs. We asked that they minimize the impact on academic programs and student services, because of course those are the core of the institutions. There was discretion given to the presidents to deal with their budgets, as including salary increases according to their specific campus needs. Each institution was in a little different place with different projects and different opportunities maybe for cost savings. So there's variation amongst the institutions as to how they handled it. We asked that if pay raises were limited in any way, that they try to minimize that impact on those mid to lower range wage employees. We ask that they continue to accelerate the ongoing efficiency efforts that were in place already and consider even more shared services, which is something we've been looking at pretty heavily in the last year for sure, but the campuses have been doing that for a long time, and so we ask that they accelerate those.
Representative Martinson has a question.
Mr. Chairman, Tammy, did any of the schools limit pay raises or should say suspend them? Or did all the campuses give pay raises?
No campuses suspended them completely. All campuses did some adjustment, but let's see, I have a summary of that right here. But they instituted it differently. Some campuses had a above a certain dollar threshold, you wouldn't receive an increase, and then it was maybe tiered down from there, where you'd be eligible for a smaller increase at a certain pay level, with the most money focused towards the lower wage employees. Some are deferring salary increases for 6 months in order to save money in the current biennium, and also to allow is to see how the state's revenue situation is keeping up before they institute those salary increases. But everybody had a reaction of sorts to it. Several of the presidents had capped their, they declined salary increases going forward for this fiscal year, as did the chancellor. So there was a mixed reaction, but everybody looked at it. There were a couple of campuses that they still are going to be giving out that average of 3%, maximum of 3% increase, because that was a priority to their campus, and they were fiscally able to do that. Other things we asked them to look at would be looking at faculty course loads and class sizes and delivery methods to see what kind of efficiencies and cost savings could be gained there. Regarding prioritizing building repairs and maintenance, some of those had to be limited.
Tammy, I have a question for you. When you talked about evaluating faculty course load, does the system have a policy on course load?
Not to my knowledge. No, we don't, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So another thing we looked at was some campuses had reserves that might be available to cover some of those one-time projects instead of using their state funds. We asked them to consider all of these things, but they certainly didn't have to do all of them. Again, there was discretion left up to the president to determine what was best for their institution. Some things we did ask them not to do. We asked them to not increase tuition or student fees to offset this general fund allotment. We asked them to not cut essential student services, unless it would have been found absolutely critical, but we asked them to not do that. And we asked them to not reduce funding in some of the emerging and high priority programs for the state or their institution.
Senator O'Connell.
Mr. Chairman, Tammy, do you have a list of the reserve funds for each campus that you can share?
We certainly can share that with you. I don't have it with me, but we do have that as far as of June 30, 2015. We could get that to the campus or to your committee.
Representative Schatz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Tammy. Did they follow those recommendations?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, they did. They did. This next slide is a really high-level summary of some of the things that were done by the campuses, and you'll see they looked at a lot of these areas. Not everybody did it the same, but they all had they all followed the guidelines. Some of the things that they did do, there were salary. No, it's okay.
I want to go back to the request for the that Senator O'Connell made, and clarify. Are you talking the regular operating reserves, or are you talking that and a separate on auxiliary funds, or what are you?
Mr. Chairman, all reserve funds, so I was looking at.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, we have a report that was prepared for the Lafferty Committee just recently that breaks that down by category, so we can give that. We'll just send that to you. And so it lists all of those types of reserves by category.
Tammy, can I address Mr. Schatz's question real quick?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, just wanted to clarify for Representative Schatz.
Come up.
For example,
With regard to high priority programs, that included the MAT training for teachers. That was unmanned systems. Cybersecurity is an example. In some cases, it made sense, like at Mayville, to actually shut down their IT program now because the enrollment was so low, but Bismarck, Minot, NDSU are picking up that slack. So there are some cases where it would look like an exception to the high priority program, but it just didn't make sense for Mayville to keep offering that with just two people, which tied it to low enrollment classes. And we got feedback from faculty members that these guidelines were helpful because now it compelled people to report to their provost, hey, you've got just a few students in these classes, we can't sustain this, we need to start to combine things. So it actually has been fairly healthy exercise across the system of asking those hard questions.
Senator Holmberg.
Or whomever wants to. When a campus, and I was looking at the eliminate programs, low enrollment, if a campus wants to create a new program, they have to go through a process that is board-driven and get board approval. Does the board have to give approval under these guidelines for the elimination of a program, or does the president have full power to eliminate a program that in normal times would require some sort of board action?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Holmberg, thank you for that question. And in fact, we are working through, well, short answer is eventually the board has to approve all program terminations like that. But obviously in these tight budget cycles where people have to respond fairly quickly, we haven't been in a situation for many years that that issue has come up, as you know, with some programs at UND. So we are working through perhaps some advanced notification process, perhaps identifying critical statewide programs, one of a kind, let's say, where if you're thinking of shutting down something, let's say, related to the law school, there's only one law school in the entire state. This would be something that you would want to kind of pre-notify, even though there is a process, we have an established process, but you can imagine something's come so late, you've already announced this, it could start having an effect on enrollment. And so we're working through perhaps a modified process in times like this. Now there's other cases, for example, Dickinson is shutting down some programs, Bachelor's of Arts in Biology. Well, those are offered in multiple campuses. There's a Bachelor of Science in Biology, and the State Board, you know, has limited capacity to be, you know, going into all these details at such a rate. So we're trying to find a way to balance out the president's latitude to respond to tightened conditions. For example, you know, we gave Mabel example of things that might seem counterintuitive but actually helps them be healthier and more responsive and not slowing them up at the State Board level, yet meet our statutory requirements. So it's a great question, and we're working.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Holmberg.
But of course, and these are more unusual times, but the way, at least I would think as an outsider looking at it, it would work that it's a de facto giving the president full authority, because once the president identifies program X, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. How does that program continue when people think it's going to go away, so you don't get any more students? So at the end of the day, the board will get a packet that will say you got to eliminate this program because there are no students in it. Well,
yes, sir. And we're working through that. We've had several discussions. The Student Academic Affairs Committee is looking at that. And again, just the ability of the State Board to manage all 11 campuses to that level of detail might be too much. So one of the suggestions I had is key programs. These key 10 priorities must come before the board in kind of a pre-notification process to avoid exactly what you're talking about. And so great question, and we're working through how to be more responsive, yet not tying the hands of an institution that has to manage within these rapidly changing fiscal environment.
Mr. Chancellor, just kind of a follow-up to that. It seems to me either you have a policy or you don't have a policy. And if the board approves additions and deletions some of the time, but not all of the time, it seems to me you're dealing with a governance function there. You're also dealing with a mission function. And, you know, historically, one of the things that I credit you and the board for really working at this now. So let's take this as a good comment. But historically, I think when you look at the programs around the state in the various institutions, there probably are some things that weren't real strategic. And today you pay the piper for that. And it seems to me that's one of the reasons that this consistency of board policy, if they make the decisions, they really are then responsible for the mission creep or not. Mm-hmm. They're responsible for strategic placement. I was struck by the fact that the one of the programs that ended up at Lake Region seems to fit nicely, I think it's a sign language program. I'm not critical of any of the decisions. I'm just saying I don't know how you manage it if you go back to the flexibility of 11 different decision makers and you don't have control of from the strategic standpoint, mission standpoint, and you're not really governing that.
Well, just to clarify, there is a policy. It is in place. The board does approve the new programs and approves the deletion of programs. It's just the speed at which this is happening because of these tightened budget conditions. So we do have a policy and the procedures. It's just as pointed out by Senator Holmberg, if you're in such a situation now where it's moving much more rapidly, you can have the situation of de facto decisions happening before it gets to the board's review. And so that's what we're working on, how to accelerate a pre-notification of something, to have this strategic level discussion you're talking about, which is why, in fact, at our retreat, Dr. Scogan is giving actually a mission brief, which I believe you'll be seeing parts of that as well. And we're moving that mission study from 2-year to the 4-year and the research institutions. So we're looking at strategic, we're looking out in the future, which many of you were there, and we appreciate your comments, but also to manage day-to-day to make sure that some strategic level decision just didn't happen in a day-to-day process. And that's what we're talking about, is prioritizing perhaps critical programs, yet not tie the hands of presidents who now cannot respond to these budget timelines. So we're trying to balance that, you know, loose, tight principles, adaptive presidents, adaptive campuses, but not doing something that is really of a statewide significance for the state board to really be early in that process.
So what would be the timeline when the board would work with it then?
We are already working on, and I'm personally involved in this, of prioritizing what things we might think would be on the list. We're having a governance breakout session on the 16th of June. We will also be receiving at that point the budget allotment plans for exactly this purpose, to be looking at what's happening here and step back a little bit and go, is there an unintended consequence perhaps happening? As you can imagine, with 11 campuses having to adapt, and we start to see, oh, hey, there's a pattern here that there's something that's de facto happening that we don't want to happen. And so the 16th will be a full day devoted to budgets, plans, thinking long term, governance, and then the state board meetings the next day.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll go back to the slide here, slide 9. Some of the cost-saving measures that were instituted ongoing costs that were reduced. Particularly in the area of salary savings. So there were some retirements that maybe happened sooner, which do save money in the long run. There were voluntary separation agreements that some institutions used. Positions were eliminated through restructuring or streamlining processes. There, as we mentioned earlier, there were salary increase limitations. And one thing that I was just reminded of when I was just a second ago, we do have our annual budgets coming in, and the Chancellor referenced that, and there's going to be some more detail on the most recent ways campuses have been adapting to the allotments. And due to the 10% base budget limitation, some of the institutions, I believe, have are considering no salary increases now for this next year. So I misspoke earlier when I said that. The allotment plans initially were put together before we knew about the 10% base budget reduction. And so now, in response to that, some institutions are relooking at their salary increases and may not have any salary increases. And then...
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Holmberg.
Go ahead. You're probably asking the same thing I am.
Would that, though, pass the pickle... Would that be an easy way to pass the pickle to the legislature by saying, you know, these nine campuses are all going to get pay increases because the governor put them in, but you're not going to get any by your own administration? Does that pass the... Does that have the potential of passing the pickle to the legislature?
Mr. Chairman, you know, I suppose someone could do that. As far as
one for, could argue that.
One could argue that, but you know, we don't intend to ask for that right now. So you know, it won't be coming from us. But you know, could someone do that? Yeah, I suppose they could.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Representative Delmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, Tammy, one of the things you had as a recommendation to the campuses was to keep in mind those people who are not at the top of the salary schedule. And, you know, a 0% raise to someone that's earning $25,000, $22,000 a year is a way different picture than what some of our administrators and others are earning. Are the campuses taking that into consideration, that there may be some where it's a real hardship and we're probably going to pay it one way or the other anyway?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I mean, they are. That wouldn't be a decision that would be made lightly by any of the institution. So they are considering all of those things.
Representative Martinson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Tammy, as you know, because you've been involved in the process a long time, that the oldest trick in the appropriations budget process is to not include something that you know we're going to include. So I would just tell you, please don't try and balance your budget request on the backs of employees that deserve their raise, because we will fund raises, but we might take it out of someplace that you don't like. So I don't want to make that a threat. I'll just tell you, we will do that.
I hear you, Mr. Representative Martinson. Thank you. I think.
Further.
You're loud and clear.
Further questions for Tammy? Further comments? Chancellor.
Mr. Chairman, back to Representative Delmore's question. In the second round of guidance we gave to the colleges after the 10%, we put that in about pay raises. Please be thoughtful to those on the lower end, because you're exactly right. Losing 3% when you're already down right at the basic income level is very different than losing 3% when you're paid what I'm paid. So we had that in there. Again, giving a guideline to the campuses to adapt on there.
At the same point, Mr. Chancellor, they can also decide that they're going to make that cut for everybody, whether you advise that or not. Will that have to be approved through the board? Will the board look at that and say, hey, we asked you not to do this. Please don't balance things off people's backs who can't afford it.
We had that discussion in the February meeting to set bans, you know, hard bands like that, and the decision was to let each campus adapt to their unique circumstances. But yeah, I was leaning forward a little bit, and in the end, the decision was to give more latitude to campuses. But we'll watch that, and I think all the presidents are being very thoughtful about their people, from what I'm seeing. They are working very well as teams, rolling their sleeves, and generally been really, you know, proud of how they're trying to get through this new environment fairly rapidly, but mindful of some of the key questions you brought up on taking the long view of things. You know, don't sacrifice the future research, the future of growth and adaptation for just current consumption. So there is some of that balancing happening as well.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tammy, you've got here one of the implemented cost savings measures is reduce the scope for capital projects. Can you give some examples of some of those reductions or changes that were made?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman. For example, at Botnell, the Nelson Science Center had a project that was going on. They, you know, looked at everything in their budget, and they weren't able to cut anywhere except in that capital project. So they reduced that project by $47,000. So then the budget for that project. So then they would have had to look at the costs of the project and try to see what they could have, you know, lowered the scope for in order to meet the new budget.
Was that common, or was that just very few instances? Because usually if there's a change in scope, that budget section gets changes in scope from time to time.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if the change in scope would rose to the level that we needed to bring it to the legislature or the budget section, we will be bringing that forward. Right now, none of them have done that. Some of the other capital type projects would have been another deferred maintenance or extraordinary repair type projects, where we tried not to cut those because most of them are critical, but due to budget considerations, there were some reductions that needed to be made. And Mr.
We will be receiving reports at the next meeting, committee members, on the current use up to this time plus the planned use through the biennium of the two-for-one match in deferred maintenance, the deferred maintenance grants, that type of thing. So we will get more information relative to that at the next meeting. Further questions for Tammy? If not, thank you. It's kind of two challenging topics, and Senator Flackel.
Tammy, just quickly, we talked about the 4% Dickinson. I think it's, if you look at 15-18.1-06, I think it's per year, if you can check on that, maybe.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Flackel, you're right, and that's the way it's written, how it's worked out. Because the legislature's only in place, or it's only here every 2 years, and the funding level is set every 2 years, how it actually was implemented last time was at a biennium level. So it really was
violating the law.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It was approved by the legislature. Just kidding.
What you're saying is that was some bad language from the Senate Education Committee that made its way through?
No comment. No comment.
Committee, we will take a 10-minute respite. We'll call the meeting back to order. The next two issues on the agenda will be taken together since they're pretty much one and the same, dealing with, I think the assignment that we got was administrative costs. I think we've expanded it to just simply the personnel costs and then administrative breakdown being a component of that. So I'll ask Brady to introduce it and then Dr. Feldner to present.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. And it has been a little while since we visited the administrative cost study, so I'm just going to review what some of the study requirements are for your information. And some of the specific duties of the study, first of all, include to look at the number of administrators at each institution, including the number that have been recently added. Some other requirements include looking at the salaries associated with those administrator positions, the overall institution spending on administrative costs. And then the study also provides for a review of options to designate any future increased funding for higher education specifically for instructional costs and not for administrative costs. And that is the final requirement of the study. At a previous meeting in November, and also I guess at an October, at the last October meeting, there was some discussion on the study, and some committee members had expressed some concern regarding the study. And at that time, it was noted by the chairman that the Legislative Council Office would work with the University System Office to look at some of these administrative costs. And Alex and I have been working with Dr. Feldner and others in the System Office on this issue. And some of the concerns that we brought forward from the committee to Dr. Feldner included using consistent data and definitions for administrators and administrative costs to try and use nationally recognized definitions when possible. There was also a concern brought forward about using FTE counts for administrators. I know at some of the smaller campuses there is concern that one individual may serve as a part-time administrator and a part-time faculty member or a different staff position. So we did feel it was important to stress that we only count that as a half position or the appropriate level of FTE. And then finally, there was also a suggestion by the committee that the results compared to other states and national norms. And so we did ask the University System Office to try to compare to national levels of administrative costs at institutions where possible, while also recognizing that due to economies of scale, some of our smaller institutions in the state may not compare so well. So Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I guess I'll turn it over to Dr. Feldner unless there are any questions of me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Feldner, and I serve as the Vice Chancellor for the University System and the Interim Chief of Staff. Before I start showing you the slides, as Brady mentioned, we've been working on this for a while. And as we've gotten going, it's been challenging, first of all, trying to come up with the nationally recognized definition. So we started with what's called CUPA data, which is the Colleges and Universities Professional Association for Human Resources. And those are the categories that you'll see going forward in this. And they're kind of broad categories. One of the issues that you'll find, what we'll see with the campuses, is not everybody categorizes their people in those same categories. So this is really a first brush at looking at this data. And then we're going to, based on some of your feedback, I think, you know, we might step back and look more at the Delta cost study data, which there's parts of that in here too. So I don't, when you start looking at this data, it's not that it's inaccurate so much as I would say that please don't hold the campuses to say, oh my gosh, this campus is bloated over here because of this. It might not necessarily be the case because of the way we're starting to pull this, and we need a little more time to get things more uniform, which I'll talk about later too. So having said that, if you go to the first slide, this is FTE staff to student ratios. And so these are the CUPA categories I talked about. So academic, administration, that piece would be staff in like the provost's office, libraries, those kinds of academic administrative areas. Academic disciplines then is your disciplines such as math, science, chemistry, English, and so on. So those administrators perhaps would be deans. Athletics is a given. External affairs would be something like advancement or alumni. IT, that is self-explanatory. Institutional and business affairs, this would be, for instance, HR, your bookstore, your food service, those kinds of things. Then there's physical plant. Student affairs would be enrollment, financial aid, records, and then research. So as you look at these, in some cases, in student affairs, a smaller ratio would probably be better if you're thinking about what would be more services to students. And in another piece, maybe a larger ratio would be a better number. However, we don't have, using this type of data, we don't have the national norms. So when I get to the next slide, we kind of changed our, what we're thinking there as we start looking in the Delta area. But to give you an example of why you can't necessarily say the campuses, why they're not, these numbers are not necessarily completely representative. If we take Lake Region and we look, they have no IT staff. That's because they have them categorized under their institutional and business affairs. There's not anything wrong with that. But what it does to that number is make the ratio look worse in that case, because there's more administrators in that area per student. So it just, it's not a, I don't want the campuses to be held hostage by this particular sheet. This is just a sample. The other thing we did, we pulled out student employees, so there's no student employees in this data, and there are no temporary workers like ticket takers or things like that in this. Let's see. We also grouped the medical school in with UND and all of the ag extension in with NDSU. So those are all included in a lump. So on the next one, this is more based on the Delta cost study comparison, where you compare it with 1,000 per 1,000 students. So BSC and External Affairs has 4 administrators per 1,000 students, if you want to look at it that way. So we're thinking more of going down this road, and maybe we'll take out the particular categories and refine that. The campuses haven't had a lot of time to get input into this. We released this about 2 weeks ago. Some of them have had time to make some changes, others have not. So, and in some cases they said, well, let's just wait and see, you know, what's, what it looks like. If we go to the next slide, this is again comparing to the Delta cost. And it gives you, this is where we get our first national average. So you can see there's a national average of the Delta cost study 2014 column. And also, this is where, as Brady mentioned earlier, your small schools are disadvantaged because they have a low student count. So the Delta cost, those are probably larger schools. So where you see the 115 ratio, obviously economies of scale will impact that number. And this is a 3-year average for our FTEs.
And Dr. Feldner, on the so if you look at UND and NDSU, then they're very close to the with the Delta project in terms of
correct
FTE employees across the board in total.
Mm-hmm.
So number of employees seems to be consistent there with the national. Correct?
Correct.
Yeah, okay, thank
yes,
you.
Thank you. Okay, the next slide is when we were, part of the study was administrative count and salaries. So here's where we started, and what I'm going to show you are the red categories first, because as we looked at just the positions in the black bands, they're called, that's, you know, the university system HR is by band and subband. There's an additional 300 employees in the black categories. We didn't have time to get that to you for today, so we will do this for next time. We didn't have their average salaries. I mean, we had who they were, but so what you're going to see first are the red categories: executives, deans, associate, and assistant deans. So on the next page is the count of this, and we thought the historic piece would get a little, the table would be huge if we went every year from 2005 to 2014, so we just did the five-year increments and did the change over time. So you can digest this. And if there's no questions on that one.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Delmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we're missing a lot of the things that we would assume are administrative positions and what information you're giving us now. Is that what you're saying? Especially with those that are called any, a rose by another name is still a rose, but it's hard to put it in that category.
Well, Representative Delmore and members of the committee, and two slides, though, you'll see the number of them, but you also asked for salary data, and that's the part we don't have yet. We have it, but we haven't, it has to be manually pulled into the spreadsheet for the historical view. That's the part we didn't have time for. So you're going to see the number of people, just not the change of their salary and the spend yet, but we will have that for next time.
Yeah, and committee, as Dr. Feldner alluded to earlier, the next go-round can be driven by your requests today. So what you're seeing here, if there's something you don't understand or you think there should be something more, or now's the time to mention it, because there will, like she said, there will be another version at our next meeting, which will provide what greater detail in terms of the administrative area. So
right. Okay. So on slide 16, administrate. I'll go to the next one. The next one is the annual average. The mean annual salary of administration, these are the ones in the red that we pulled and have this historical data. So you can see the percentage change at each of the five-year increments. And then from 2005 to 2015, the percent change. And the where we, I should mention that where we got the cost data was the IPEDS reporting. That was the, rather than pulling it just straight from the system, we used what the campuses report to IPEDS as the annual capital outlay or the annual salary outlay to these positions. So it's an average. So whether the position is 9 months or 12 months, this is the average based on what's reported to IPEDS. So if you look at that and you say, well, wait a minute, I know that particular salary is incorrect, right, because it was pulled from IPEDS. This was the quickest way we could get this to you and for now, and we can keep refining this too. But it gives you an idea.
Representative Martinson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you have really got a lot of information here that's, it's hard for me to kind of, I'm still looking at one page when you turn to the third page ahead of me. So I think, you know, for our next meeting, we need to spend a little more time on this. And then I would ask, Mr. Chairman, are you going to break it down by campus when you bring it back on positions and salaries and stuff?
I can.
Well, don't you think, Mr. Chairman, that would be important?
I concur. Yep.
And, you know, I looked at the, I'm still thinking about the very first chart with the ratios of student to, you know, and I probably have lots of questions on those, mm-hmm. you know, to try to, what does this mean? You know, why is one so much, the ratio is so much different than the other ones? Because shouldn't they all be kind of similar?
Representative Martinson, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Well, Perhaps kind of, but size still makes a difference. I mean, one of the things I'm curious about in the data, too, is are we taking that 0.5 FTE? I'm sure that in the small campuses, there is a person who is doing 5 different jobs, and are they reporting it that way so that that person is one-fifth student affairs, one-fifth facilities, one-fifth? I mean, I don't know yet. Or so there's those kinds of questions I have, too, and that when we have very small campuses, when you're comparing them on a national average, that's tough for them as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one of the problems, at least, that I have is, and I was one that I wanted you to do this work for us, but then I look at it and there's so much here. You know, you think like the FTE staff to student ratios, you know, what does it mean and what do we do with it? You know, why does one school take, they can do something for one in 40 students and the other they can do it in one to 75. So are they more efficient or what are some of the reasons why there's such a variance in the employee to student ratio? And I see, like as an example, you have DSU and North Dakota State School of Science. They don't even list athletics. So they've got to be accounted for some other place, right?
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chairman, you know, it is a lot of data, and if later on you have questions and you want to give me feedback tomorrow after looking at it, and then we can do that too. After you think on it for a while, or email it to me too.
You know what I'm thinking would make some sense going forward with the next iteration would be when you have a version of that available. Maybe what we will do is we will share it with the committee. Don't have to be in a meeting to have that, and just simply say you've got 24 hours to look at this and suggest compile that and then let all the committee members know the suggestions that have come back from the committee and that these are things that we're going forward with. I certainly understand that it is a lot of data. Senator Flackel.
Mr. Chairman, Lisa, will the board eventually establish goals or benchmarks that they wish to, you know, be better than or equal to or better than with some of this? Or what's the intent? I mean, because this is good and fine, but.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Flackel, Chair Nesset has asked that this be presented next week at the retreat, so the board has a chance to look at it as well. This is the first time this data has been shown. I mean, it's part of our joint study with the council and the board, and so I would say yes. Once they get to look at it, we'll get more direction as to, you know, how they want things categorized. But no, they haven't seen it yet. But I believe that is her intent.
And I would just add to that while this is a legislative study, and that comes to this committee through the combined wisdom of 147 legislators. No snide comments about that now. The hope would be that when you go to this work and you have this detail and you have some kind of common agreement, that essentially what you would have created would be a nice monitoring piece that would just be there, and it would answer a lot of the, but board members would have it, be able to use it, operationally, and for those of us that sit in appropriations in other areas, it would be comforting to know that this is the deal, and that they're spending their money wisely and this type of thing. So, Mr. Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to add a little bit, and I want to thank Dr. Feldner and their staff for the work they're doing on this. It really is hard. But interestingly, we walk back briefly to last summer when I arrived, when we had six studies, several of them are joint studies with you, that part of the driver here, talking to the cabinet, and several of the presidents are here, is that there had been such good years, and the staffs may have grown, they may not have grown, but it was hard to get people motivated to start thinking cost savings, reductions, et cetera. There's been a complete sea change since last summer, and presidents are looking at all this stuff. One of them had convened at 8 o'clock in the morning meeting, you know, a couple months ago, saying, okay, now we got to really roll up our sleeves. There's a driver here now. And so part of this study was a driver to say, gee, this is interesting. At the two-year tier, the four-year tier of the research, you're kind of out of balance. We're benchmarking. They all understand now that every time they can save something administratively, they might have more money for the students. Similarly, the retention, I don't know if Dr. Hagen is here, but he convened a retention task force saying every student we keep is maybe a half a job. And I'm going to actually ask the cabinet to have what we call rapid retention task force of shared lessons across all of them. We'll talk about it in July, and by September, if there's some key things they find work, help improve retention at a faster rate than the study that we're doing. So anyway, I think almost everybody that I have talked to welcome the study. They're looking at the data, but they're also highly motivated now to look at these things each individually and answer those hard questions that were brought up by Representative Martinson and others, like, well, what does this mean here? So I think we're making good progress with the study for you, but also, most importantly, at each campus, they are making real efforts to find these efficiencies, which in the past weren't so urgent to do. So, in answer to your question, Senator Flackel, it's going to the board, it'll be there to benchmark things, but also each campus now is fairly motivated to find these efficiencies themselves.
Thank you.
Okay. The next slide is the one with those positions that we have not yet gathered salary data on, but we will work on that. And if there's no questions on that one, the next slide is faculty count.
Oh. Senator Nelson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Feldner, looks like we got a whole stream of directors. What's all included in that definition? What is a director? Who is a director? Whatever.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, I'm not exactly sure I can answer that without looking at a specific campus. And I don't, if you, I know there's a lot of campus people behind me, if you want one of them to answer it. We just pulled it by the band in the system. So they were identified in that band, that job sub-band category.
Well, Mr. Chairman, with 161 of them floating around up there, this is like the director of the library, the director of food services, the director of what?
They're saying yes.
Okay.
Well, it seems to me that one of the things that would go with the next iteration, and as this is refined, would be clarification of what each of those titles entails, not necessarily. There's 161 definitions for the, but the kinds of tasks that are involved with that.
And Mr. Chairman, as we were pulling data, we found that this was interesting as well. There were a lot of titles, and that's why we didn't really dig into them yet, because there were a lot of versions of titles. For future.
And I think, committee members, you may recall we took a look at a brief look at the Delta study at a previous meeting. I think, in fact, it was at Devil's Lake. And one of the things that trended with the Delta study was that there was this category that they weren't quote-unquote traditional administrators, they weren't faculty, and so they were called professionals. And that probably includes directors in a lot of cases. And that's a national trend that, if I'm recalling now, I think there was a growth in professionals, there was a growth in part-time faculty and instructors. Full-time professors, I think, was level. There was a significant reduction in the other staff, unclassified, non-classified staff. And there was pretty level numbers for traditional administrators and for traditional faculty or professors across the country. So when we look at directors here and this kind of thing, it probably is going to, if we go the next level down into the study, it probably is going to come out that they're quote-unquote professionals, and that doesn't answer your question, but it's an issue in every state.
It doesn't answer my question, but looking down this list, there's five different types of directors, some of which I think are all the same thing, except they're just called something different on different campuses.
And I think in the Delta study, the professionals were folks that traditional administrators would look at them and say, well, that's a student finance officer. That's not a administrator. Faculty would look at that and say, well, they're not in the classroom, and they are, quote-unquote, managing something or whatever. So it's just as uncomfortable a term as directors, but it or evasive, I guess, but it is the national trend.
Okay. Next slide. The next slide is the faculty count. This is IPEDS data. And before somebody asked me the question about no academic rank, I forgot to ask Jennifer what that meant, if that's adjunct or what. So I would have to get back to you on that one. Unless Tammy wants to email her really quick. Okay, and then the next slide is the faculty mean annual salary. And this is also IPED's salary data. So it's the annual outlay or average cost to maintain the position, whether it's 9 or 12 months. So then my last slide, which is next steps, is we're going to keep working on this, and we'll go back and get those remaining banded positions and get all the directors clarified, which is that first bullet. And then we'll work on doing a market comparison with other states or on the salaries and make comparison the rest of those FTE positions to the Delta cost study. So we'll work further on that. Plus, I took notes of what the questions you were asking. And then if you've come up with more, I'll write those down. Or you can, like I said, you can email them to me.
Dr. Feldner, and since you'll be working with the board on this, was it next week?
Yes.
I think it's really important what's valuable to them. I mean, we're every other year, and they're kind of there routinely, regularly, and so I'm hopeful that that what works for them, I'm pretty confident will work for us in terms of the kind of information we need. But I think it would be important to have something that would be useful to administrators, board members, and answer a lot of questions. Matt, excuse me, Representative Klein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Feldner, would you expand a little bit? I'm looking at the 9, 10, 11, and 12-month contracts. How is that determined, and about what percentage runs in each area?
So, Representative Klein, members of the committee, what we did on that one, because that one is almost, that would take a huge amount of time to pull it from our, maybe not the average, but from the system. So what we got you was the IPEDS data, which means the campuses report those numbers to IPEDS, and IPEDS averages the spend, the annual outlay. That's how that was calculated. So it is apples to apples per se across the campuses, but what it doesn't say is which ones we have that are 9 month, 10 month, 12 month, and so on. So that would be a different, we would have to pull that from PeopleSoft. That, and we can do that, but that's kind of a chore.
Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, is it like the full professors are usually 12 month, or does that enter into it at all?
I believe we'd have to ask one of my colleagues, because I'm not the academic. Please.
Dr. Scogin.
Mr. Chairman, is this okay, boss?
Please.
Okay. First, it's a little confusing because it says academic staff, and what we're really talking about here are the faculty. So when we talk about staff, generally, we're not talking about the faculty. Two different, you got faculty and you got staff. And then as far as contracts, most of your faculty are 9 month contracts. So they start work in August, and in May, right after graduation, they're driving off campus, and most of them you don't see unless they're teaching summer school again, but they're on 9 month contracts. But there are exceptions in particular areas. So being very parochial about it, Bismarck State College, for example, many of our energy programs are taught for 10 or 11 months. So we will contract with faculty, we will negotiate a contract with them where they're actually faculty, but instead of 9 months, they've got a 10-month contract or an 11-month contract. And in some cases, the department chairs, who are certainly BSc, are all counted as faculty. Maybe some of them will be on a 12-month contract. So they're still faculty, but they're on contract for 12 months. But most of your faculty, most of the people on this list here, as professor, associate professor, and so forth, are going to be 9 month faculty.
Thank you.
Senator Flackel.
Mr. Chairman and Lisa, just to be clear, I mean, when we have the non-academic rank and we're saying their staff and such, it's not counting any graduate students who receive graduate stipends to teach. Is that safe to say?
Senator Flackel, Mr. Chairman, what Jennifer got back to me is that one that say no academic rank means the institution classifies them as faculty but doesn't give them any rank according to the definition, or they're contracted to teach but they don't have a rank.
Yeah, adjuncts or whatever. But to my question though, about graduate students aren't included in here. Yes,
we'll ask
no?
Her. We'll ask her. You want to ask her? They're saying no behind.
I mean, it doesn't seem like it would be.
Right. I don't think they would be, because the way we pulled it in PeopleSoft, they would have had a band. And I don't think that you would have graduate students in there on a band like that, on this band.
Yeah. I mean, the only exception would be if you have a person with a master's who is already on staff, as a lecturer or something, who is pursuing a PhD, who's teaching, blah, 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 blah. That would count, I'm guessing, but not a
That's what I'm
kind of standalone, right? Graduate students who's there primarily to matriculate.
Right. I think that's correct.
Committee members, as you look at this, this is homework now. As you look at this and you have a question or you have a suggestion, please get them to Brady, and we will get back to Dr. Feldner after the in more detail after the her work with the board next week.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Feldner. Thank you also to your personnel that assisted and even at all of the campuses as well that have worked on this. I think we've taken care of the 250 item where we had discussion earlier related to budget issues. And so what we will do at this time is we will go to the 310 agenda item, which features the comments by Valley City State University. And it's kind of time for the Valley City show and tell here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm really excited. Our campus is very privileged and happy that you are on our campus visiting. So thank you very much for selecting us for your meeting today and tomorrow. I also want to sincerely thank you for all the support that you've given the university and the time to make a couple of remarks. Before I go into my remarks, I wanted to go over just a couple of logistics. After the presentation here today, I know that we need to pause for open comment, but then I would like to ask those who are able and interested to join us right behind this building so that you can actually see the flood wall going up in front of Foss Hall. Once when there, we'll also have a bus. We're very excited about the Valley City Wellness Center. It is a fabulous town and gown relationship. We did receive $1 million of the challenge grant, which we were really privileged to help with this building. But what's really unique about it is the academic space that is within the facility that's going to help our students and be successful in health and physical education, working in a wellness facility, as well as just strengthening our relationships, the way the lobby is laid out, and the coffee and the conversations you'll have with the same people that you'll bump into at the grocery store. So we're excited about that, and for those of you who are interested, we will bus you right over there. It's not very far from the facility. Did you want to make any comments about that, Larry?
Thank you, President Mason. I would just indicate that we have some limitations in terms of the number of folks who can tour at any given time because of the construction that's going on within the facility. So we have scheduled a quick tour at 3:45 and another one at 4:15. And they're about a 20-minute tour. Our focus is going to be on the academic space that Dr. Mason references, but we'll take you to the facility and bring you back. As soon as we're through with the visit to the flood wall and Foss Hall, we'll depart for the Wellness Center.
Okay, and then from 6 to 8, we are hosting a reception. We're excited about this. We've invited some of our local city administrators and some folks for you to meet as well. We are co-hosting it with, we're very proud of our Valley City Great Plains STEM Education Center. You may receive, actually in your handouts on page 3, I believe, you'll see a little information about the $300,000 grant we received from DPI, which is helping our STEM Education Center improve K-12 classroom instruction. And part of that is a summer camp for teachers, and they are here on campus today. So when you come to our reception today, we have it set up a little bit. We've got our food and our beverage, and we have stations with active demonstrations from teachers in K through 12 talking about how they're impacting STEM education in the classroom. So we hope that you'll have a lot of fun, enjoy your colleagues, and also visit with the teachers. You can talk to them about their professional development opportunities. For this session right now, what I'd like to do is simply talk about two things. I want to talk first about our students, and then I want to talk a little bit more about the Flood and Foss Hall. We are so proud of our students. And nationally, we talk about, and you hear about, 5- and 6-year graduation rates. Today, I would like to share with you some information that you probably don't hear much about. Students who graduate in less than 4 years. In the last 5 years, so that's students that entered between 2007 and 2012 at Valley City State University, 33 students graduated in 3.5 years, with an additional 10 students graduating in 3 years, all on their own accord. So let me introduce you to four of them. This is Shelby Hartman from Mandan, North Dakota. She graduated with a Bachelor's of Science in Elementary Ed. She had a lot of these students live on campus and have very active co-curricular activities, such as a Viking ambassador. She was part of Alpha Lambda Delta Honor Society. She started college with only 4 college credits, so she didn't get a lot of leg up from you know, the dual enrollment. And she finished her coursework in 3 years, and then she did a semester of teaching. She graduated summa cum laude. She's currently teaching summer school in Bismarck Public School District, and she's interviewed and hopes for a permanent position in the system as well. This is Tara Cleveland. Tara actually is from Minnesota, and I am told that they have a lot of students that come in from Minnesota actually usually have more college credits. So you'll see a little difference from Tara. She's a software engineering major. She just graduated in May. Her list of involvement is so long that this is just a small sampling, but she's been an RA, a tutor, an ambassador, on student senate, orientation, basketball team, published her undergraduate research, a couple of impressive internships, another one where she helped build a website for our Chamber of Commerce. She started college with 35 college credits. She graduated summa cum laude in 3 years. And what's really fun for her employment story is that after her internship, she actually started her senior year already with a contract for employment when she was going to graduate. That must take a lot of pressure off your senior year, right? This is Madeline Zane. She's from Newburgh, North Dakota. She's a business process integration management major. She also just graduated in May. Like Tara, she has been extremely involved from Student Senate. She was the president this past year. She's been involved with the North Dakota Student Association as an officer, Honor Society, Viking Ambassador, United Way. She received the Business Department's Outstanding BPMI Student Award. She started college with 6 college credits and graduated with all these activities, magna cum laude, in 3 years. Jenna Coughlin's actually a Valley City student and from Valley City high school. She double majored in health science and exercises science and a minor in chemistry. Very involved in her pre-professional club. She was president. She's been on track field, cross country, another student that we see highly engaged throughout the campus. She started college with 4 college credits, graduated magna cum laude in December, 3.5 years. She's currently working as a certified personal trainer, and she'll attend grad school in physical therapy in the fall. Throughout higher education, we have learned that students really pave new paths. And although several enrollment experts will tell you that students are far too interested in the social side of college to complete degrees faster than average, at VCSU, we do not believe that to be the case. That is why we are pleased to shine a spotlight on these students and other students who have forged a way for other students to formalize our 3-year degree programs. And to share more information with you is someone you're familiar with, Dr. Julie Russell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, honored guests. I really, it's hard for me to describe, but this is really a great privilege for me to have the opportunity to address you for the second time in just a few months. I really think this isn't something that can happen in larger states with larger populations, and I really feel special to be able to speak for our campus and for our programs. We recognize that there are many teaching areas in North Dakota that are shortage areas. We continue to prepare teachers, but we think that if we can prepare them more quickly and more efficiently and streamline the costs for them, that perhaps we can do our part here at Valley City State to address some of these teacher shortages. So our response to that has been one of Dr. Mason's goals, and that is to develop 3-year programs for bachelor's degrees. And I will show you those programs in just a few minutes, but right now I have a little video presentation, and if you'll keep your fingers crossed and hope that the technology gods are smiling on me, perhaps it will play for you. We have no sound. There we go. I'd like to say that I drew all that myself, but that's not exactly true. But I thought that this format might do something to entice students and parents to take a look at these programs. We have just recently sent out invitations to those students who are qualified for this program, who meet those minimum qualifications that you saw in that video. And we're anxious to launch this in the fall. We have a number of programs of study already developed, and I'd like to try to show you at least a couple of those if I can. Let's see. Yes. And so this is the website that we've set up for our 3-year undergraduate programs. It's relatively simple. You can see that we put the Emmy award-winning video at the top, and then a quick question-answer kind of place for students to look carefully and see what do they need to do to be qualified for this program, how can they get involved. I'm really hoping that some parents take a look at this, because in addition to the room and board funding that we've identified in the video as savings in what would have been their fourth year, there are also a number of fees and incidentals that they won't have to pay for if they complete their degree in 3 years. So this could be a path to not only addressing some of our teacher shortages, but also saving our students some money in student loans and other funding mechanisms. So, for example, under elementary education, we have the program options. As many of you are probably aware, elementary education, as do many of the education programs, has a number of endorsements available to students. And so we have set up the elementary education program with three options for endorsements that can be completed in 3 years. And in addition, we have business administration, English education, mathematics education, and professional communication. So we are really excited about this. This is very clearly in keeping with our mission as a learner-centered institution, and our hope is that we will be able to add more programs to this list as we work through the process. And as we get the word out, we'll have hopefully quite a few students that are participating. Anything else? Yes, Senator.
Do you find, as you look at the programs, are there some programs that structurally just will not fit into this kind of arrangement? Have you identified that yet, or?
I have not identified that yet. Elementary education actually is quite challenging to fit into this structure. Perhaps lab sciences might be difficult to fit into this structure. But I really don't know a specific answer to your question. I think it takes a lot of creativity on the part of the program and the part of the faculty to look at what do we have and how can we offer it in such a way that it fits into this kind of a pattern. And what helps us here is that we're actually requiring 2 summers of study, one on campus. And the beauty of the on-campus piece is that while they won't be here for 4 years, they'll have a summer here in a cohort where they all take the same classes at the same time and live in the same residence hall and eat together and study together and create relationships that might tend to be more lasting than some of the other relationships that they get during the year, because it'll be more intense.
Representative Klein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you explain if they're carrying an excess amount of credit hours? Are they charged by the credit hour, or in this program, is that covered?
The tuition at Valley City State University is per credit. The students still complete the same number of credits as they would in a 4-year program, but they do it in a shorter period of time. So the savings doesn't necessarily come from the tuition. The savings comes from the living expenses and the fees that would be incurred in a fourth year.
Senator Blackwell.
I have a question for President Mason whenever. I just don't want to get away here. My question is, we've discussed this ad nauseum sometimes on merit scholarships, because I know we're talking about that tomorrow, but essentially if they're completing in 3 years, we give them a somewhat of a promise of those that are eligible for a merit scholarship of $6,000, but because they're completing in 3 years, they in essence don't get that. In the past, we've talked about having it available for summer school in order to get them through the system quicker, make a greater utilization of classroom space in the summertime, which is a little lower. Have you guys, are you folks, you know, your campus discussed anything with that in terms of the merit scholarships and how it might impact these students? I mean.
Yes.
And?
I would say that there were two primary buckets to walk through. One was the academic and making sure we're meeting all the internal and external qualifications academically. The other is the financial piece, financial aid, scholarship allocations, even our own internal scholarships. Some of them weren't eligible in the summer, and we've had to spend this whole past year rethinking and working through those models so that the students could have the financial aid to do this. I'll also tell you, in a focus group with students, remember, we know that we've already had 43 students doing this on their own without us reworking these models, that one student in particular had 4-year McCready scholarship from us, so all of her tuition and her books and fees were paid. She graduated in 3 years, and she wanted to know, why can't I, as I go on and teach, enroll in your master's program? And we hadn't even really had that conversation because I wasn't really aware that 43 students had done this on their own. So we're starting to rethink that model as well so that students can continue their education. Another one of the students that is here today has gotten a full scholarship as well, and she said that she would be able to graduate early but decided instead to get a double major and pick up more credentials that she felt would make her more valuable when she left the institution.
And let me follow up, maybe. It would seem that it would be pretty difficult for them to complete in 3 years without going to summer school. I mean, the vast majority of them attend summer school to some extent.
Summer hours. Some of them that I spoke to that have been through the program had to do it with overloads as well, larger, and they've been capable of doing that and pretty excited and proud of it.
I do think that we amended the scholarships this last session to where you can do it just a number of semesters. So if they wouldn't lose anything by going the merit and the needs based. I think now include counting summers, so it's just a certain number of semesters that you're eligible for, whether they're summer or during the academic year.
It may be that we learn that the people that are going through the program by themselves are the capacity and that the other students aren't interested, but we feel like because so many students are doing this on their own that it is worth our time and our investment to give people the opportunity, and it will either be successful or we'll learn more information about how to help students progress through college at a rate that's reasonable and get them moving on with their careers.
Could we have Brady check on that? Because I know we extended it to, you know, some graduate programs and some of those different scenarios where they're done in 3, but they have to take 4 for, you know, at starting their 4th year, become technically a graduate student, even though, you know, so I just don't remember that it was for summer school because I don't ever remember establishing a summer school rate.
Further questions or comments? This is exciting stuff. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to compliment Valley City on taking the risk to go ahead with this. Kudos to you. I did my schooling in less than normal, and it sure was efficient.
Thank you, and thank you to all of the people that have been working on this. At this point, I'd like to move on then, if that's okay, with the a couple comments about permanent flood protection. Is that permissible?
Yes. But before we proceed, I just want to, while she's on her home turf, say thank you to Professor Russell for she wowed us and mine at their couple of months ago with stories about what's going on at Valley City, and so thank you for a repeat performance here. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Transitioning then to permanent flood protection, and I really just want to say that we are so grateful for the support that we've had. As you know, floods have devastating impacts on communities, and the health and the well-being of this community in particular is very important to me. And so this protection means probably more to the people of Valley City than most will ever realize. The wall that you've probably seen part of it driving into town is being built in 6 to 7 phases. And we were very blessed when our city leaders made the deliberate decision to start with phase one right at the institution. The problem we're having is the building, the Foss Hall building, is too close to the river, and therefore the flood wall has to be built in front of the building. So let me give you a better perspective by sharing this footage from an unmanned aircraft. We're starting on the on College Street and heading west toward Foss Hall. And this is, you'll see the panel, which is the base, which is the wall. And if you look back here, we have large panels that would be inserted that are stored by the city in case of a flood protection. We're now approximately in front of the campus quad, and where the orange is, which is where it is right now, is in front of Foss Hall. It's interesting as you get closer to the construction, and what we witnessed earlier is how deep, these are almost like icebergs, the way they build these walls, so it goes really deep. As we approach the building, you'll start to see how close the wall is to the front of the building. In a minute, you'll have an aerial view, and you'll be able to see both the riverside as well as the front of the building. It's clear that this is an island. As you zoom up, you'll see on the other side of the river is an apartment complex, which will be taken down as well in the very near future. So again, after public comment, for those of you who are interested and able, we would love to have you right behind this building. It's a very short walk. And then for those who are interested, if you want to get on our People Mover, we'll take you over to show you the integrated academic and wellness center space. Are there other questions?
So what do you do in the meantime? When you've got this circumstance,
we are using the building.
Okay.
And so, it's just a matter of when the next flood comes. And it should, we know that we're in a very difficult financial situation. We're very understanding and respectful of the fact. Should there be an opportunity to proceed with that next building that was on the trigger, our communication and fine arts building, we would, the money in that project was not only to take down Foss Hall, but also McCarthy Hall, which both meet the requirements for deferred maintenance for the buildings to come down. So we actually would take down two as we build one new building.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was there no way at all to put that wall around on the other side? You said that the apartment building on the other side of the river was going to be torn down, so it would seem that if that was not there, they could have widened the channel to the river and built the wall on the other side. But maybe it was too much deferred maintenance and...
No, it had nothing to do, there is a deferred maintenance on that building, but the decision, as I understand it, they looked at every single opportunity to save that building, and it just, from an engineering perspective, it couldn't happen. So right now, I mean, we can sandbag if we get flooded, but we'll be sandbagging around the building.
So in the meantime, though, you are using it, and if you don't get another flood for 20 years, it'll maybe...
We'll continue to use the building.
But you're still working on building a new building to replace it. I mean, it isn't going to happen immediately because of the financial...
Correct. The history of the city is that it's not a 100-year flood. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And so we share that information with you openly so that everyone can make the best decisions. And that's how we're planning to move forward.
President Mason, this project was one of the two contingency projects that were approved. This was the first one.
This was the first trigger.
Yep, first trigger. That doesn't look like a lot of room between the front door and the... On a personal note, I have a lawn that takes 2.5 hours to push that mower around. I'd trade it for this one now. Further questions or comments for President Mason? Okay, thank you. We will organize after we look at comments, and then we'll get for the trip. So, okay, at this point on the agenda, the committee is available to hear any comments regarding anything on the agenda or on our work list of studies from anybody in the audience, anything that they want to bring to the committee's attention. Okay, nobody's going to have anything to offer on that, so Senator Robinson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to compliment you as our chairman representing the committee at the Envision 2030 event here 10 days ago. Our chairman led, and some of you were in attendance, a lot of discussion, kind of an overview presentation, and I thought you did a great job, and appreciate your efforts. I thought it was, even sitting on this committee, very very informative. So good work.
Thank you. I'm still not buying, though, but okay, let's then organize for the who are we? Would you like to organize in a couple of groups, or do you want to go one large group?
I think for FOSS, it's right behind this building, so we can just organize in one large group.
Okay.
People can queue up. We've got a lot of staff people as well that will help. But it's just a quick, you know, there's nothing like standing in front of the building to experience it, yeah. So we're trying to provide an experience. And then from there, we'll talk about who wants to get on the bus to go over to the Wellness Center.
Okay, we'll just follow President Mason then. Yes.